You want me to just tell you a little bit about myself then for your audience, and then you can do the same for my audience?
Sure. What's the name of the podcast?
The name of my podcast is called The Freedom Experiment. I'm the host of it. I usually have myself on there and somebody from my family or a friend that I'll find, and we talk about different issues pertaining to freedom and liberty.
All right. And I'm Michael Dean. I do the Freedom Fiends podcast with Nima Vidati. I do the Anarchy Gumbo podcast where I interview different people. You're going to release this on your cast we talked about, and then a while later, like a week or two later, I'm going to release it on the Anarchy Gumbo and then link you. And also a filmmaker and an author. I've written a bunch of books and made a few Liberty movies and a few movies before I became a Liberty person. I've directed the Guns and Weed, the Road to Freedom movie, directed Gun Training with the Non-Aggression Principle. Those are my two Liberty things. And also directed DIY or Die, How to Survive as an Independent Artist. Hubert Selby Jr., It'll Be Better Tomorrow. And I think one other. I'm having trouble remembering everything I've done because I'm still full of turkey leftovers, and it fogs the brain, man.
I'm full of turkey too.
All right, this is day after Thanksgiving. Yeah.
can you talk about the non-aggression principle? Because I haven't touched on that in any of my podcasts.
Yeah, it's basically something that's so simple. You know, you can explain it to a 5-year-old in about a minute. But it's so, it's harder to explain to adults because they're so conditioned by 12 years of or more of public indoctrination schooling and the horizontal enforcement of living in society and thinking that things have to be done by aggression, by proxy, through voting. Basically, the non-aggression principle is, it's kind of like the golden rule. You know, it's don't do harm to other people. It's do not initiate aggression. Now, aggression is different from violence. The non-aggression principle doesn't say if you're attacked, curl up into a ball and let the person kill you. It's not being a pacifist. Mm-hmm. It's if someone comes at you with aggression, you know, like classic example, someone on the street pulls a knife or a gun on you and you shoot them to stop them from killing you, you did not initiate aggression. You used violence only as a means to prevent violence. And that's considered ethical under the non-aggression principle. But that's it. Nothing beyond that. No initiating aggression. No going out of your way to harm other people. You know, the golden rule covers it. The oath that doctors take, do no harm. You know, don't go out of your way to harm somebody. And libertarians and anarcho-capitalists and voluntarists and agorists all live by the non-aggression principle. It's the number one rule that supersedes all other rules, and all rules follow from it, and all ethical law follows from it. You know, people say, well, without a government, there'd be chaos in the streets. You know, people that are anarchists, they don't want any laws. And it's not true that they don't want any laws. They just don't want laws imposed by executive bodies who vote themselves salaries and placate voters to get things done. I mean, basically, you know, we're taught as kids in America and in most of Western Europe and a lot of the world, you know, we're taught that democracy is the greatest thing in the world. It's the greatest form of government. But democracy is basically half of the people plus one aggressing on the other half of the people through aggression or by proxy. You know, I mean, Hitler was elected democratically. That was a democracy. You know, there's all these countries in Africa that are really horribly tyrannical, but they all have democratic in the name, you know, the Democratic Republic of this, that. The word democracy is a word that tyrants use to steal. And in America, most, you know, basically there's about six things should be illegal. And there's really one thing that should be illegal, and that's aggressing on someone's property or person, you know, which basically comes down to don't rape, kill, assault, battery, don't murder, steal, commit fraud or theft, you know.
Back to the non-aggression principle, where does the state get it wrong? Where do nations get it wrong when they say that they're actually protecting us and engaging in self-defense that we must fund through taxation. Where do the states and nations get it wrong?
In the entirety of what they do. Self-defense is necessary, and it's really hard to argue with statists, you know, people who believe that the state is their god, which is about 95% of all people or more. And when you tell them these things, when you tell them the non-aggression principle, they either look at you like you're crazy, you know, or want to turn you into the government, which is absurd. You know, I mean, I kind of look at teaching people this stuff, mm-hmm. Like teaching the slaves to read back in the 1850s. You know, in the 1850s, before slaves were freed, it was a crime to teach a slave to read, because if you taught a slave to read, they knew more about the world and could do things, you know? And a lot of people look at doing media like you and I are doing as teaching the slaves to read. And they get really nervous about it. They get really upset about it. Or they just think it's insane. I mean, they say, well, the government protects us. And a lot of the ways that governments protect their market share. And basically, a government is a way that thieves get together and legalize their thievery, and not only make it legal, but make it mandatory. You know, everybody works for the government, or has a relative who works for the government, or has a relative who's in a government protected union. So it's almost like treason to say to somebody, well, you know, I don't think that we need the government to do this. And, you know, it goes from everything from like national defense down to like collecting the garbage. Now, national defense, there are arguments that are kind of complicated of how that could be done without a government, you know, how you would protect large areas of people. And I don't even like to get into that. And because there's people that do it so much better than me, and it's not a cop out to say that, but I like the Stefan Molyneux argument of, you know, when people say, well, we need the government because without the government, that wouldn't happen. That's like in 1850 saying without, you know, I'd like to end slavery, but we can't because the cotton wouldn't get picked. You know, right. When people say, well, if you can't tell me who would build the roads, I'm not going to listen to you. I mean, who would build the roads? Road builders, the same people that build the roads now, except the ones that stand around while the rest of them work. So I don't really see, I see the ethical issue first with the immorality of imposing government on people. And then secondarily, I see it is destined to fail. Historically, democracies going back to Greece have failed in 200 to 300 years. And basically why they fail is because more and more people realize that they can vote for a living instead of work for a living. And that doesn't mean that most people don't vote work in America. You know, people work in America, but they're paid at an unfair market. They're paid at something that the market wouldn't bear. I mean, you know, union members working in American car companies are paid like $40 an hour to turn bolts. In a private world, it wouldn't be worth $40 an hour plus a pension to turn bolts, you know. And most of what police do, I mean, they're in a free market, in a libertarian paradise, or libpair, as I like to say, there would be some kind of security force. It wouldn't be paid for by stolen money. And when I say stolen, all taxes are collected at the barrel of a gun. And people say, well, I pay taxes and I've never had a gun held to my head. And I'm like, exactly. You know, if you don't pay your taxes, you know, 6 or 8 months later, they'll send you a letter. You ignore that. A couple months later, they'll send some men to your house. You tell those men to go away. A couple months later, they'll send the same men back with other men with guns. If you refuse, they will point guns at your head, throw you to the ground, and either kill you or take you and put you in a cage. So taxation and government are all immoral because they're collected at the barrel of a gun to do what 51% of the people think is right. You know, think about drug, I don't even do drugs, but drug laws and the war on drugs are just absurd to me. I mean, if you think about, nobody is being protected from anybody by marijuana being illegal. The only thing that's being protected is the jobs of cops, prison guards, courts, lawyers, the pharmaceutical industry, the alcohol industry, the tobacco industry. I mean, that's who wins from that, and everybody else loses. Right. We've got, and politicians just lie. I mean, our president right now, part of one of his campaign promises in 2008 was that he would decriminalize marijuana. After he was elected, he was voted I'm sorry. He was asked at a kind of town hall meeting thing, like, "Hey, you going to make good on that promise?" And he laughed and said, "I don't think we'll be doing that now." You know, a lot of people elected Obama. I get them mixed up. I really do. A lot of people, you know, voted for Obama because he was black. He was different. He didn't sound like George Bush. George Bush was a mean old white dude who wanted to take everything away and send everyone to war on a lie. And Obama is continuing that war that was based on a lie, on more lies. He's killing black people in Africa. He's bombing innocent people, you know, bombing 50 people at a wedding party to get one guy. He is jailing more black people than George Bush did for drugs. Like, he's way stepped up the war on drugs. And people just elected him again. Now, I don't really see an option. I mean, Romney was just as bad, if not worse. Ron Paul was a lot better, but I still didn't vote. I don't vote. I can't see the idea of using government aggression to save us from government aggression, which is what voting for Ron Paul would be, because he would have to use the force of the government to dismantle the government. And the fact that he was shut out so heavily and systematically by the GOP and by the mainstream media, both the left and right side, which are basically, you know, the same side, just kind of proves, and the fact that so many Americans believed, oh, Ron Paul's horrible, really makes me not have a lot of faith in democracy or people in general. And then people say, well, okay, without a government, though, and you don't have a lot of faith in people, without a government, you know, it'd be chaos. And I'm like, no, it wouldn't, because most people who rob for a living in libertarian paradise, face it, literally would be shot in a robbery day one, you know? And that sounds horrible, but if people make their whole life putting their boot on the neck of other people, it is self-defense for them to be shot when they'd have to actually go steal for themselves. They wouldn't be able to steal by voting. They'd have to actually go do it, and they'd be gone. I don't know if that answered your question, but there you go.
Yeah, it totally did answer my question, and I totally agree with you, and that's how I feel about democracy as well. It's just that one year, more than half is going to enforce their values and rules on the other half that lost. And the next year, it'll be another half that gets to enforce their values and rules and stuff. So to me, yeah, it's just two sides of the same coin with the democracy.
Absolutely.
And the majority never makes something right. If it's right, it's right. If it's wrong, it's wrong, no matter how many people vote on it.
Yeah.
And I agree with you. Most people haven't sat down and heard an alternative view. And I was one of those people. And like you said, it comes from the indoctrination from the school system, because it's not broken down to us in that way. To me, if school systems was really for enlightening and educating people, I think it would be more geared towards reality. I mean, we don't even talk about what reality is, what propaganda is. We don't even have a foundation to build off of when we start the school process. They just give us a bunch of unrelated facts, which makes people uninterested and bored.
Yeah, I mean, public schools teach you to, they basically are based on a model from the 1800s that taught people to be good factory workers or soldiers. Schools teach you to show up at the same place at the same time every day for years and years and years, do what you're told, sit in neat little rows, memorize facts, spit the facts back, and not really think. Plus, they add a whole lot of government indoctrination into schools now. They did when I was a kid. I'm 48. I went to school in the 70s and early 80s. And it was a lot. It was kind of more right-wing indoctrination, and now it's left-wing indoctrination in public schools. But it's still the government. I mean, you start every day with pledging to the flag,
right,
which a lot of people don't know. Actually, the Pledge of Allegiance was written by a socialist, and he basically wrote it and got it into schools because he was in the business of selling flags. So.
That's hilarious. I hadn't heard that story before.
So how'd you come to Liberty, and how long ago that happened? And, you know, what's the short version of your journey?
The short version is I finally got a smartphone. My dad told me to download TuneIn. I started listening to Alex Jones, and I heard him make a reference to the Peace Revolutions. So I started listening to the Peace Revolutions, and then finally I stumbled upon Complete Liberty with Wes Bertrand and School Sucks. And that was probably about in May of this year. And that's when I finally came to Liberty. Before then, I thought everything was the fault of big corporations. and evil, greedy, rich people.
Yeah, so did I.
Our society.
How did you, and to an extent they are, but only to the extent that the government backs that, you know.
To, right, because they constrict the market.
Yeah, I used to be anti capitalism, and then I realized there's a difference between capitalism and corporatism. I am anti-corporatist, which is capitalism combined with government enforcement. So, yeah. I still shop at Walmart, but I ain't going there today, man. People stab each other at Walmart on Black Friday. Or what is it? Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
Yeah, I like Black Monday, which is the internet Black Friday. I can sit at home and not get stabbed. So, how'd you find the Freedom Fiends?
I found the Freedom Fiends on TuneIn Radio, too. I think I was listening to either Alex Jones or somebody else, and I heard somebody mention the Freedom Fiends, so I just popped it in there and started listening to you guys.
You still listen to Alex Jones?
Not as much. I listen to more of Complete Liberty, because he was more interested in politics to me, and not the root issue of no state.
He's a voter. He's a small government guy, and I won't say he's nuts, and I don't like to damn things by calling them conspiracy theories, because you know, some things that were considered conspiracy theories at one time are fact now. But I listen to him. I used to listen to him, and I don't anymore. And I can't count the number of people who've told me that they started their journey with Liberty started with the Freedom Fiends, and I mean with Alex Jones, and then later they graduated to the Freedom Fiends.
Yeah, I can believe it, because he's so enthusiastic. You know, he draws you in.
Yeah. So what? I'm really psyched that there are so many people starting Liberty podcasts. I mean, it seems like 10 new ones have started in the past couple months. What led you to want to do a podcast?
I've always loved public speaking. I was in sports. I played ball at Purdue, and then I played a little bit professionally, and I always had to do public speaking engagements. And so it was natural for me to want to do a podcast once I had something that I was passionate about and wanted to speak about.
Who'd you play professionally for?
I just played in the ABA. I played in a tour in Chile.
Nice.
And that was it. I tried out with the Indiana Pacers in 2002, and that was the end of my playing career.
What's your full name? Because we have some sports fans. They'll probably want to look you up.
Rodney Smith.
Cool.
Just Google Rodney Smith Purdue basketball, and it'll come up. A Rodney Smith Pacer tryout.
Cool. I'm doing that right now. Oh, there you are. Yep, Purdue. Cool. So,
how did you get started with
Liberty?
Liberty
and podcasting. I was actually doing podcasting years before I got into Liberty. My wife and I did a podcast starting in 2006. That was it was actually about sex, and and it was called Submission and Coffee with Dalai Lama, and it was about kinky sex. And we did 184 episodes, more than one a week. It was weekly, but sometimes we did two a week. We did it for about two and a half years, and then I just got busy with other stuff. I write tech books for a living and make documentary films, so I got busy with that. But I got into podcasting really early. I mean, it started in like 2005 or so, and I got into it in 2006. It was invented by an MTV VJ from the 80s named Adam Curry. Do you know who he is?
Yeah, he has a show now, right?
Yeah, he has a show now, and he actually has his own streaming network, and we do a live show on there on Thursdays.
Okay, so that's cool.
That is cool.
Created it.
Yep.
Why is it called a podcast?
Because it's a combination of the word iPod and broadcast.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because originally that was before there were smartphones. Like the only way to really listen to an MP3 away from a computer, it was with an iPod back then. So yeah. But let's see. So yeah, I did. You know, I mean, I've always been pretty good at audio production and recording. I played in bands. I'm 48 now. I've played music since I was 14. I was in bands, in some punk rock bands that, you know, first we put out our own records, like we'd pay to have 1,000 7-inch vinyls pressed up, you know, go into a cheap recording studio, and then like put the record covers together ourselves because we couldn't afford to get them professionally done. So we'd go to Kinko's and get them printed on cardstock and then have a party and buy some beer and fold them up and stick them in a plastic bag.
Oh, that's cool.
And, and then later I was in this band in San Francisco. That was in Virginia and D.C. And then later in San Francisco, I was in a band called Bomb.
Uh-huh.
from 86 to 93. And Bomb got signed to Warner Brothers, did one record on Warner Brothers. And so I've been in a lot of recording studios back when it was done, before computers, when it was done on, you know, multi-track tape with, you know, tube microphones and tube preamps. So I've always been really interested in recording technology. And then the price of stuff came down drastically in the last 10 years. So, you know, it used to be that it would cost you, you know, I mean, even a home, like the studios that we recorded in, the equipment in them probably cost, back in the day, I mean, $1 million worth of equipment in one room. And the studio time was like $100 to $300 an hour. And then back then, even a home studio, you know, cost you $30,000 or something. And then with computers and trade opening up in China, the price of stuff went way down to where now, like, I would say, you know, the equipment that I do this podcast on, and my stuff's kind of fancy, but it's like less than $500 worth of stuff. And Nima Vidati, the guy I do the podcast with, I live in Wyoming now. I used to live in California and DC and Virginia, but he lives in Austin, Texas, and we do it over the internet. It sounds really good. And we do it, you know, he has about $500 worth of gear, except for his DJ mix and stuff, which he doesn't use in the podcast except for music. But just his recording stuff, I mean, you know, we make music that sounds as good as stuff I used to do in a studio on like $500 worth of equipment each. So it's really gone down in price, and you can actually do it a lot cheaper than that. I mean, I do a lot of blog posts. I sent you a bunch of them. They're long. You'll probably be reading them for the next 3 weeks if you pay attention and, you know, follow the links on them. Okay. But, you know, for about $100, you can get the equipment to do a good sounding podcast, you know, instead of doing it on a smartphone or whatever, or a headset. And I recommend that if people really have an idea that they want to do, to just start it with whatever equipment they can have. But I always encourage people to upgrade as quickly as they can. And, but people make a lot of mistakes with it. Like, one thing is people generally buy condenser mics. Do you know about the different kinds of mics?
No. What's that? What's a condenser mic?
Well, a condenser mic is, they're usually bigger than I'm using a dynamic mic, and the dynamic mic I'm using, like, when you see a band on stage or you see a rapper on stage, the thing that's in their hand is usually a dynamic mic, and it's usually in a Shure SM57 or 58. That's standard at every club to every stadium in the world, and they cost about $100 each. They're not overly sensitive. They don't pick up a lot of stuff from the side. They only pick up what's right in front, so they don't feedback. They don't get a lot of handling noise. And they have a good sound for a reasonable price, and they're pretty much indestructible. I mean, you can, like, literally drive a nail with that microphone. It'll still work. I wouldn't recommend it, but it'll still work. Whereas a condenser mic is extremely sensitive, and they're kind of fragile, and they require phantom power, which a dynamic mic does not. So most people, when they're starting out, if they don't know anything about audio production, they go, oh, those condenser mics look sexy, and I've seen people in studios using them. But you don't want to do that, because especially if you're new to audio production, a dynamic mic is the way to go. A dynamic mic is also what's in pretty much every radio station in the world. Like, every DJ uses it. They don't use condenser mics, because a dynamic mic will pick up your voice and sound really good. A condenser mic will pick up your noise. It'll pick up, like, you scratching your shirt. I'm going to scratch the mic, but that's how it's going to sound with a condenser mic if you're touching your shirt or scratching yourself. It's also going to pick up the refrigerator in the next room, and it's going to pick up the truck going by out on the street. So you don't need to pick all that up. You don't need a mic that sensitive to do, you know, talk show kind of stuff. So,
That's for, like, spying on people,
or, you know, recording in a studio where you have a trained engineer who really knows what he's doing, and he's trying to get the most perfect sound possible. And there's no background voice noise in a studio, because it's totally sound conditioned and soundproof. But if you're in a house, which is where most podcasts are done, there are noises. You know, I have cats, I have a wife, I have a refrigerator, I have a, you know, street outside, and a dynamic mic won't pick all that up. And I spent $130 on mine. But you don't have to spend that much. I actually have a recommendation, which you can link some of those links I sent you, and then I'll link them when I put this up too. I have a suggestion for a $17 mic that's really good.
Okay.
And now you will need a mixer with that, with a USB input, but you can get those for 50, 60 bucks. So, you know, between the mic, a mic stand, you know, a pop filter for the mic, and a little mixer to go into your computer, you know, 100 bucks, right, tops. Okay. And then you need some audio editing software, but there's a free one that's really good. It's called Audacity. And, you know, you don't need to spend a lot of money to get decent sound. So okay. One of my goals in the Liberty Movement is not just teaching people about Liberty, but also teaching people about audio production. You know, it's kind of like, because I know a lot about it and a lot of people don't in the Liberty Movement. So I do a lot of blog posts. I don't make any money on them. You know, I mean, I guess I put Amazon links where I get a nickel if somebody buys something. But, you know, it's not something I do for money. I don't make a lot of money at it. I spend a lot of time at it. And it's because I want to teach Liberty people how to make better media. Cause I really think that until our stuff is of the quality of like NPR or Fox News or C-SPAN or CNN, it's not going to be paid attention to. So, you know, it's kind of like, teaching people about Liberty is teaching the slaves how to read. Teaching people how to use microphones and cameras well is like teaching the slaves how to run the printing press. And that's even scarier than teaching them how to read. So that's what I do.
Okay, that's cool. Well, I'm glad you took time out to tell me because I had no clue. I was just happy to start my podcast.
Yep. Hang on a sec. Let me save this file.
All right.
So I'm rolling.
All right.
Yeah.
All right, Michael, can you tell me why you think that marijuana and hemp has been kept illegal for so long in the United States?
Yeah. I mean, the history of it goes back to, a lot of people know this, but a lot of people don't. So I'll give the quick history of it. Alcohol was illegal in the late 20s, early 30s for about 10 years in America. And it was actually a constitutional amendment that passed that. So anybody who drinks and worships the Constitution, which I think you'd have to drink to worship the Constitution. But, you know, and I say that, I mean, like, I have respect for the Bill of Rights, but it's like writing something down doesn't grant rights. And it's been ignored ever since before the ink was dry. So the Constitution won't save people. Only education will. I sound like Jesse Jackson. It is not it's not the Constitution. It is the education. Wait, that didn't rhyme. Okay. That's why I do the music and Nima does the rapping. He's better at it. Okay. So alcohol was illegal and it didn't stop alcohol. It actually increased the potency and availability of alcohol and turned it into a criminal element with a lot of murders going on. And that's also how machine guns were outlawed. A lot of the stuff in America that people don't understand where it came from, like it's just laws we accept now, are either based on racial issues or power issues or money issues. That's pretty much why all laws were passed. I mean, it's always been illegal everywhere to rape, murder, kill, steal, or commit fraud. And beyond that, the other half million laws there are in America don't really do much and usually do more harm than good. But the first gun laws were to keep freed slaves from being able to defend themselves against the KKK. The first time the government got involved with marriage was to prevent interracial marriage. The outlawing of marijuana in America was driven by money and racism. I mean, basically they were like, jazz musicians like to smoke weed and the press made people afraid of jazz musicians and said that weed made them want to rape white women. So, basically the reason hemp was outlawed in America was alcohol prohibition failed miserably. So they repealed that amendment and made alcohol legal again. But then there was this whole class of people, of government thugs, of alcohol enforcement agents that suddenly had nothing to do. So basically, they outlawed marijuana to give them, you know, to continue their job. And it was done largely by William Randolph Hearst, who owned most of the newspapers in America at the time, had almost a near monopoly on the media. And he also owned a lot of forest land. You know, he owned the forest land where they cut the trees down to make the newspapers. And hemp, which is the same plant as pot, hemp can be used to make paper, and it's actually far more efficient for making paper than trees, because trees take, you know, 40, 50 years before you can plant, you know, you plant a seed for a tree, 40 or 50 years later, you can harvest it and make paper from it. You plant hemp, 4 months later, you can harvest it. And you can, out of the same amount of land, you can get hundreds of times the amount of paper or rope or other, you know, hemp industrial products out of that same amount of land in a 40 or 50 year period. So he was really opposed to it, to progress, you know. So he used his newspapers to publish scare stories, you know, basically, if you allow this to get legalized, Negroes will rape your white daughter. And Congress outlawed it without even knowing what it was. Like, nobody in Congress knew what marijuana was. Some of them knew what hemp was because it was used for rope. But they didn't know what it was. They just were scared and bullied into passing this law. So suddenly pot was illegal. Actually, it wasn't illegal. It was illegal to own without paying a tax on it. But they didn't issue any tax stamps. So that's how they got around the fact that it was unconstitutional to outlaw it completely, or there was no constitutional basis. They used this bit of like voodoo law of saying, well, now it's taxed, but we're not going to let anybody pay a tax on it. I don't do drugs. I used to be a heroin addict and an alcoholic, and I've been sober since 94. Okay. But back in the day, in the late 80s, I actually, one of the things I did for heroin money was I participated in a government study on marijuana, where I went once a week for 4 weeks to a hospital, and they had me smoke pot. They, like, you know, before I'd smoke it, they'd like weigh me, take some blood, take my brainwave measurements, and do all these tests on me and have me do a quiz on paper of math stuff. And then they'd have me smoke a joint, and then they'd have me do all those tests again. And they paid me $100 a day plus $100 for completing the study after I was done, because so many people dropped out of it, because it's kind of a buzzkill having people poke and prod you all day and make you fill out forms when you're high. So, but I actually smoked government marijuana that had a tax stamp on it. It came in a pack that looked like a cigarette, like generic cigarettes, like black and white, white pack with black printing on it. But it had a tax stamp like printed on it, and it said all taxes paid. And it was 20, you know, research grade marijuana cigarettes. That's what it said on it. That's pretty, that was weird.
That is weird.
So yeah, I smoked government weed.
So is it true that hemp can grow in a lot of places in America that other plants can't grow? And is it true that you can make like hemp oil or hemp fuel? Or
yeah, you can power cars on it. I mean, literally, well, hemp, you know, the reason it's called weed is because it grows like a weed. I mean, it'll grow in the hottest, driest climates. It'll grow in the, you know, wettest climates. It grows in Alaska, which is, you know, part of the Arctic, and it'll grow, you know, the further south you go, the better it'll grow. I mean, it grows really well in Mexico and Colombia, but it grows well in California, Texas, et cetera. It'll grow pretty much anywhere that there's water and sunlight, in almost any kind of dirt. And that's not true of trees, you know, for forestry products. I mean, pretty much most of the paper in America comes from the Pacific Northwest. It's a unique combination of soil, lots of water, and lots of sun, you know, sun and shade in the right combination, and altitude. That's all needed for paper products. So, yeah. And it could basically, I mean, it might be a little bit of a push to say it could solve all of the world's problems, but it could solve a lot of the world's problems if the government just got out of the way and didn't try to regulate it. I mean, basically, if there were a free market in pot, there would not be an energy shortage. There would not, you know, this is not even getting into the medicinal or, you know, party time uses of it, which there's no problem with. I mean, basically, one of the things that made me a libertarian, one of the journeys on it, was my only kid, my daughter Amelia, died of leukemia in 2006 at age 24.
I didn't hear that.
Yeah, and it was heavy, and it was like she smoked pot. She never smoked pot before that. She was like, you know, she was kind of like such a good girl. I was kind of like, oh, come on, man, don't be so square. But, you know, her mother was really religious, and she was religious, and like she never even drank. And then she got cancer, and to deal with the chemo and the pain of just the cancer, a doctor actually said, well, I can't legally tell you to do this, but you should go find some pot and smoke it. And she did, and it gave her relief. And the thought that somebody could have thrown, you know, my dying child in jail for something that gave her a little bit of relief just made me hate laws and hate government. And people say, well, you should, you know, don't break the law. You should work to reform it. And I'm like, tell me that when your fucking kid's dying, okay? Right. Tell me when your kid's got 6 months to live, you're going to go spend 10 years fighting Congress. You know, so I was just like, yeah, do it anyway. Even though I was, you know, long sober at that point. So that was a really important piece of my puzzle. And I never really liked pot. I liked alcohol and I liked opiates, but, you know, I smoked pot, but I didn't like it. And I would always prefer other things. But I have no problem with anybody smoking it. I don't think they should need a government license to do it or permission or taxation or anything. And I think that marijuana legalization efforts are really, I mean, I like it. I like that a couple states recently legalized it. And I'm really intrigued to see how that plays out with the federal government. And I'm really intrigued to see if, you know, Washington and Colorado, who've legalized it by vote, if those two states get away with that, like if the feds don't just go in and start beating people up, if they get away with that, I'm really intrigued to see how that's going to play with states' rights for gun ownership, because it's the same deal. Have you seen the film that Neem and I made called Guns and Weed, The Road to Freedom?
I've only seen some of it.
Yeah, I've seen
the whole thing.
I'll send you a link to that. I mean, basically, it's a thing that we made. It's a 99-minute documentary that we made to show to, I mean, a lot of pot users are anti-gun, and a lot of gun users are anti-pot. So we kind of wanted to reach across the aisle and show that, you know, all rights are the same thing. And I think we succeeded to an extent. But yeah, industrialization of hemp farming, I mean, there are medicines you can get from it that aren't even related to like the THC content. It basically is a substitute for petroleum. It could be a substitute for petroleum. You could make biodiesel out of it. It's a substitute for building materials. I mean, in France, they do this. They actually like build it and mix it with small amounts of concrete and build houses out of it. And you can use it, you know, as a fuel. You can use it as medicine. You can use it as a lubricant for car engines. I don't even, you know, it would... I'm forgetting some of the industrial uses of it. Clothing, rope, paper, you know, fencing. You could build houses out of it. I mean, it's, and it grows anywhere. It's kind of a, I hate to sound evangelical, but it's kind of a miracle plant in a lot of ways. Plus, it can get you high and it doesn't kill you like alcohol does.
No, that's right. It sounds like what you're saying is that if hemp and marijuana was legalized, it would put economic power back in the hands of the people.
Yeah. You know, an interesting thing, my dad is 91 and grew up in the Great Depression, and he was a farmer, a dairy farmer, but during World War II, he actually grew hemp for the government. The government actually issued tax stamps to farmers to grow hemp to be used for ropes in the war effort, and then as soon as the war was over, like, outlawed it again.
Wow.
And he doesn't like marijuana, and he doesn't even want it legal, but he grew it for the government, you know, as his patriotic duty during World War II. So even the U.S. government has in the past admitted the power of the industrial uses of hemp. So there's a film that you can find on the internet called Hemp for Victory. It's produced during World War II. It's a black and white film produced by the government to show farmers how to grow hemp industrially.
Wow. That's wild.
Yeah.
It's real wild.
It is.
People wouldn't believe it. People wouldn't believe what you're saying right now. And it just, to me, if I was the government or a big business, I wouldn't want hemp or marijuana to be legalized either, because people could make some of their own products or even make some and sell it themselves.
Yeah. I mean, government's out of control, and I see more examples of it every day, but government becomes out of control by nature. I mean, there's no way for that to not happen. I mean, just a few examples I can think of government out of control are, you know, SWAT teams kicking down doors, kicking down the wrong door and shooting people and killing them and getting away with it and getting medals for it, you know, for facing danger. And, you know, I heard someone say recently, the idea of a SWAT team is the idea that shooting a grandmother or a child or a family pet is less important. It matters less than keeping people from flushing, you know, keeping people from flushing their pot if they kick down the door.
Yeah, it's crazy. And let me ask you, I agree with you. How do you give a government, well, with the mere existence of a government, it's supposed to have the ability to make and enforce laws. How can you expect to control something that has ultimate power?
You can't.
That's what I don't get. That's the argument people always say. Like you said, that you should work within the government to reform it. Like, how do you? You can't control it.
Yeah. All we can do is educate as many people as possible until it can reduce the demand for it. You know, basically, I mean, you ever listen to a podcast called Bad Quaker?
No, I've heard you or somebody else talk about it.
You should check that one out, man. It's the best podcast in the world for liberty. It's better than Freedom Fiends. And the guy who does it, Ben Stone, he points out that there's a difference between the government and the state. People use those words interchangeably, but the government is the machinery of it and the people of it. And the, you know, the government is the buildings, the cops' guns, the cops' badges, the salaries, the politicians, the hall, the marble halls they meet in. That's all the government. The state is people's belief in all that and belief that that's right. And, and if the state went away, if people's belief in that went away, I mean, the government would still be around for about 2 weeks, but it would just fail after about 2 weeks. It couldn't be there, you know, if people just stopped supporting it. And I'm not even telling people like stop paying taxes or whatever. I pay taxes because I don't want to get guns to my head. I bitch about it on the internet 24/7, but I, you know, I obey all laws as they stand now. I think it may get to the point where doing the things I do become illegal. You know, I mean, I think they're going to crack down on free speech. I think they're going to crack down on everything to the point where people kind of notice they're slaves, but then it's too late, or they'll think it's too late. But, you know, I really think that the biggest thing people can do is understand the non-aggression principle and understand that everything government does is enforced with a violation of the non-aggression principle, you know, with force, with the threat of a gun or a cage, and teach that to as many people as possible. You know, if you wake up one day and you talk to somebody about that, and even if they don't get it, they might get it later. If you explain it well, you know, I think you've given a good day, and you could go to sleep with a smile on your face because you've talked to one person. If you could talk to a bunch of people, it's even better. So that's what I do every day, you know?
Right. That's what I do every day, too, at work with all my friends. And that's why I'm motivated to do the podcasting, is to get this idea out there, because I want everybody to be free.
Yeah.
I think that was good.
You think that's a good ending place, you mean?
Yeah, I think that's a good
ending place. Yeah, it sounded like redemption in the third act to me.
Yeah, it did. Because you talked about everything we talked about in the beginning.
Well, cool, man. I'll just say thanks for having me on. It's been an honor. And worms, which is how I say word.
All right, man. It was nice meeting you. And I hope we do it again.
Cool.
Are you one of the 12% of Americans who still approves of our government? Then we need your help to force the other 88% into compliance. When you're not busy spying on your neighbors or squinting at everyone, tell anyone who will listen why more government is a good thing. You'll get a warm and fuzzy feeling demanding more taxes and arguing in favor of gun control while militarizing our police, because folks just aren't smart enough to handle real freedom.
That is so square. Check out the additional Freedom Fiends show, Freedom Fiends Live, every Sunday on the LRN.FM streaming feed or satellite radio.
Broadcasting live and worldwide from a windowless bunker inside a mountain near an undisclosed location in the rural Wild West of the occupied states of America.
Freedom Fiends Live expands on the Fiends weekly Wednesday podcasts, but now we're kicking the hornet's nest live. Talk back to the back talkers every Sunday from 5 to 7 p.m. East Coast time. From the makers of Guns and Weed, The Road to Freedom. Freedom Fiends Live. Call in soon before we get droned.
Check out the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast.
Michael W. Dean of the Freedom Fiends cooks up a very special blend of liberty, guns, sex, rock and roll, drugs, and thriving in spite of the state in an increasingly worrying world. All with a rotating cast of nifty guests who are also up in the middle of the night. The Anarchy Gumbo Podcast, a tasty stew of freedom and fun. Subscribe at kittyfeet.com. That's KittyFeet.com.